Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, on a warm spring morning in the city of Seattle, Washington, City Council candidate Pat Murakami walks from house to house. Murakami greets voters in an economically mixed neighborhood. It is a tradition for political candidates in the United States to meet voters and ask for their votes. For Murakami, it is also a way for her to ask for money in a special campaign financing program in Seattle. Under the program, the city mails each voter four $25 democracy vouchers that they can give to city council or city attorney candidates. Voters can give the vouchers to one candidate, split them among different candidates, or choose not to donate. The money from vouchers not used by voters remains with the city. I would have been a complete non-contender without the program, Murakami said of her first race in 2017. She beat six other primary candidates before losing in the general election. During the 2017 election in Seattle, there were 15 primary candidates in the city council race. The candidates received $1.1 million from the voucher program. Nearly half of them said they would not have run without money from the vouchers. This year, 72 candidates registered to compete for seven seats. That made the city council race the most competitive in more than 15 years. Supporters say the voucher program brings in candidates who otherwise would not consider running for office. And it forces politicians to pay attention to people who donate small amounts of money. It gives candidates the chance to say, "I'm going to raise my money by speaking to my constituents, rather than dialing for dollars to big out-of-state donors," said Ian Vandewalker. He is a campaign finance expert with the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University. A University of Washington study also found that Seattle voters were more likely to vote if they donate their vouchers for candidates in the city's elections. Seattle's public campaign financing program is one of at least eight programs started by local governments around the U.S. since 2015. Now entering its second election, Seattle's program is getting national attention. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand of New York, a Democratic presidential candidate, proposes a similar program for federal elections. She has said a federal campaign financing system modeled on the Seattle program could provide $200 for each voter in what she called democracy dollars. Voters could give the dollars to candidates in presidential and congressional races. Vandewalker of the Brennan Center, however, said expanding a local voter campaign finance system to the federal level would be difficult. He added it would likely require more administrative labor and be more complex than other public finance models. In Seattle, the 2017 program cost about $1 million in administrative costs alone before a single voucher was collected. Meanwhile, the Pacific Legal Foundation has brought legal action to stop the program for two Seattle residents. The program is paid for by a special property tax, and the legal case says it is a violation of taxpayers' rights to use the money to pay for candidates' campaigns that they may not support. For candidates like Murakami, the program is the difference between running and not running for local office. During her unsuccessful 2017 campaign, she collected almost all of her $172,000 in donations from the vouchers. Without the vouchers, Murakami said, she never would have attempted to run.
The world's last total solar eclipse happened in August 2017. Millions of Americans stopped what they were doing to observe the eclipse, which passed over parts of the whole United States. A total solar eclipse happens when the sun, moon, and Earth perfectly line up. The next total solar eclipse will happen on July 2nd. However, the total eclipse can only be seen in a few places in the world. This year, the path of totality will pass over areas of Chile and Argentina. The U.S. space agency NASA says the sun will be completely hidden by the moon for up to 4 minutes and 33 seconds during this eclipse. The upcoming event has led people from around the world to make plans to travel to Chile's northern Coquimbo region, where the total solar eclipse is expected to be visible. Local officials say they expect more than 400,000 visitors to come to the area. A total solar eclipse is rare. The European Southern Observatory estimates that any specific place on Earth sees just one, on average, once every 360 years. Visitors from around the world are expected to flood Coquimbo in the coming weeks for a chance to witness this uncommon event. The Coquimbo region sits on the Pacific coast at the foot of the Andes Mountains. Heavy demand means many hotel rooms are full ahead of the eclipse. Flights to Coquimbo are offered by Chile's LATAM Airlines, as well as low-cost carriers Sky and JetSmart. Travel companies report airline tickets are selling out very fast. A clock in the coastal town of La Serena shows a countdown to the big day. "People have gone mad," one person from the town told Reuters about all the local excitement. They want the day to come as soon as possible. Chile is a popular place for astronomers to visit. The country has many large international research telescopes. "It's a unique occasion," Chilean astronomer Ivo Saviane told Reuters from the La Silla Observatory that he oversees. "For everyone, whether from Chile or abroad, it's exciting." Chilean president Sebastián Piñera is one of 150 VIPs with tickets to watch the eclipse at La Silla. Piñera has identified the eclipse as one of the most important events in Chile this year. The country is set to hold several major international conferences in 2019. Luis Calderón is an engineer in La Serena. He told Reuters he thinks that the cost and effort of visiting Chile will be well worth it. You have to be here to see it, even if it is just a couple of minutes, he said. I'm Brian Lynn.
Processed foods like chips, soda, and frozen pizzas are full of salt, sugar, and fat. Now, scientists are trying to understand if there is something else about such foods that may be bad for humans. Scientists have already linked low-cost packaged foods to rising obesity rates around the world. Obesity is a condition involving too much body fat. It increases the risk of many health problems. Three recent studies offer more clues on how our increasingly industrialized food supply may be affecting our health. The researchers created a system that places foods into four groups. The system says highly processed foods are made mostly of industrialized materials and additives. Sodas, packaged cookies, instant noodles, and chicken nuggets are some examples of highly processed foods. But also included are products that can seem healthy, such as morning cereals, energy bars, and some kinds of yogurt. Researchers at the National Institutes of Health conducted a four-week study involving 20 people. They found that people eat about 500 more calories a day when fed mostly processed foods. That is compared to when the same people were given less processed foods. The researchers permitted the 20 participants to eat as much or as little as they wanted. They were taken to a medical center so their health and behavior could be observed. In another study, researchers in France found people who ate more processed foods were more likely to have heart disease. A similar study in Spain linked eating more processed foods to a higher risk of death in general. When fed less processed foods, people in the study produced more of a hormone that controls hunger and less of a hormone that causes hunger. The reason for the reaction is not clear. The scientists also found that people ate processed foods more quickly. Kevin Hall is one of the researchers who led the study. He told the AP that processed foods are usually softer and easier to chew and swallow. Hall noted the source of nutrients might make a difference. For example, fibers from whole fruits and vegetables may be better for making people feel full than fiber added to packaged foods such as energy bars and yogurt. Avoiding processed foods can be hard, especially for people with limited time and money. Processed foods can also take many forms. In addition, companies continually re-engineer products to make them seem healthier. The newest studies may provide more reasons to avoid processed foods, but they also call attention to the difficulty of coming up with ways to do that.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. 1968 was a presidential election year in the United States. It was also one of the saddest and most difficult years in modern American history. The nation was divided by often violent disputes about civil rights and the war in Vietnam. President Lyndon Johnson had helped win major civil rights legislation. Yet, he had also greatly expanded American involvement in the war in Vietnam. By early 1968, it was almost impossible for him to leave the White House without facing anti-war protesters. Johnson wanted to seek another 4-year term as president, but his popularity kept dropping as the war continued. He understood that he no longer had the support of a majority of the people. In March, he announced that he would not be a candidate.
I shall not seek, and I will not accept, the nomination of my party for another term as your president.
One reason Johnson decided not to seek re-election was a senator from Minnesota, Eugene McCarthy.
I intend to enter the Democratic primaries in 4 states, Wisconsin, Oregon, California, and Nebraska. The decision with reference to Massachusetts and also New Hampshire will be made within the next 2 or 3 weeks.
McCarthy competed against Johnson in several primary elections. Primaries are held before the political parties hold their presidential nominating conventions. Thousands of college students helped the McCarthy campaign in New Hampshire, the state that traditionally holds the nation's first primary. They told voters that their candidate would try to end the war.
My decision to challenge the president's position and the administration's position has been strengthened by recent announcements out of the administration, the evident intention to escalate and to intensify the war in Vietnam, and on the other hand, the absence of any positive indications or suggestions for a compromise or for a negotiated political settlement.
Johnson won the New Hampshire primary, but McCarthy received almost 42% of the vote. After McCarthy's success, Senator Robert Kennedy of New York decided to enter the campaign. He was a brother of President John Kennedy, who had been murdered in 1963. Robert Kennedy had served in his brother's administration as Attorney General, the nation's highest law enforcement officer. Many people were pleased when Robert Kennedy announced his decision. They liked his message. He said, "I run to seek new policies, policies to end the bloodshed in Vietnam and in our cities, policies to close the gaps that now exist between black and white, between rich and poor, between young and old, in this country and around the rest of the world." On April 4, 1968, civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr. was shot to death in Memphis, Tennessee. Robert Kennedy informed a largely black audience in Indianapolis, Indiana, of King's death and appealed for calm.
What we need in the United States is not division. What we need in the United States is not hatred. What we need in the United States is not violence and lawlessness, but is love and wisdom and compassion toward one another, and a feeling of justice toward those who still suffer within our country, whether they be white or whether they be black.
No words, however, could calm the anger in many black communities. Martin Luther King had peacefully led the civil rights movement. His assassination led to violence in more than 100 cities across America. Hundreds of people were killed or injured. National Guard troops were used to help police end the riots. After the riots, another candidate decided to join the campaign for the Democratic presidential nomination. The new candidate was Vice President Hubert Humphrey. The primary season continued. Eugene McCarthy and Robert Kennedy tried to show voters how different they were. Many voters, however, saw little difference between their positions on major issues. Both men opposed the war in Vietnam. Both supported social reforms and civil rights. Kennedy defeated McCarthy in the primaries of Indiana and Nebraska. McCarthy defeated Kennedy in Oregon. The next big primary was in California. Kennedy said he would withdraw from the campaign if he did not win the primary in that important state. Robert Kennedy won the California primary.
My thanks to all of you, and now it's on to Chicago, and let's win there.
He might have gone on to win his party's nomination for president. And perhaps he might have even won the presidency, just like his brother, John. But Americans would never know.
Senator Kennedy has been shot. Is that possible? Is that possible? Senator Kennedy has been shot. Possibly shot in the head. I am right here. Rafer Johnson has a hold of a man who apparently has fired the shot. He has fired the shot. He still has the gun. The gun is pointed at me right at this moment.
Robert Kennedy was shot at the Los Angeles hotel where he had just given his victory speech after the California primary. He died a few hours later. The man who shot him worked at the hotel. Sirhan Sirhan was a Palestinian refugee. He said he blamed Robert Kennedy for the problems of the Palestinians. America's two major political parties held their nominating conventions in the summer of 1968. The Republicans met first. They gathered in Miami Beach, Florida, and it was soon clear which candidate had the most support. Richard Nixon had been the Republican nominee in 1960. He lost to John Kennedy. 8 years later, Nixon was a strong candidate to win the nomination again. The other candidates were Ronald Reagan, the governor of California, and Nelson Rockefeller, the governor of New York. On the first ballot, Nixon received more than twice as many votes as Rockefeller. Reagan was far behind. Most of the delegates then gave their support to Nixon, and he accepted the nomination. Spiro Agnew, the governor of Maryland, became the nominee for vice president. The Democratic convention was very different from the Republican one. The Democrats were the party in power. Protests against the war in Vietnam were aimed at them.
Peace now! Peace now! Peace
Thousands of anti-war protesters gathered in Chicago, where the Democratic Convention took place. The city's mayor, Richard Daley, ordered the police to deal with them severely. Many of the young protesters were beaten. The federal government later ordered an investigation. The report said the riots in Chicago were a result of the actions of the police themselves. Inside the convention building, the delegates voted for their nominee. They did not choose the candidate who had done so well in the early primaries, Eugene McCarthy. Instead, they chose the more traditional candidate, Hubert Humphrey.
Surely we have now learned the lesson that violence breeds counter-violence, and it cannot be condoned, whatever the source.
The vice presidential candidate was Edmund Muskie, a senator from Maine. In the general election campaign, Nixon and Humphrey both supported American involvement in Vietnam. But both of them also talked about finding ways to end the conflict. And they talked about finding ways to end the social unrest in the United States. Many voters saw little difference between the two candidates. A third candidate in the race was the governor of Alabama, George Wallace. As governor, Wallace opposed federal efforts to end racial separation in the South. He attempted to block the court-ordered registration of two black students at the University of Alabama in 1963. At that time, the university accepted only white students. The two were later admitted under federal protection. Wallace campaigned as the candidate of the American Independent Party. He denounced the federal courts, as well as communism and what he called the Eastern establishment in the United States. Many conservative, working-class Americans agreed with him and supported his campaign. About 6 weeks before Election Day, public opinion surveys showed that Nixon and Humphrey were very close. Nixon's major problem was his past. He had made enemies during his early political life. Humphrey's major problem was his current job as vice president to an increasingly unpopular president. About a month before the election, Humphrey said the United States would halt bombing in North Vietnam. But President Johnson did not give the order until 4 days before the election. Humphrey later said the delay had damaged his campaign beyond repair. On Election Day, Richard Nixon won, but not by much in the popular vote. George Wallace won 5 states and finished a distant third. Nixon would become president. It was a job he had wanted for a long time.
I saw many signs in this campaign. Some of them were not friendly. Some were very friendly. But the one that touched me the most was one that I saw in Destler, Ohio, at the end of a long day of whistle stopping. A teenager held up the sign, "Bring us together." And that will be the great objective of this administration at the outset, to bring the American people together.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.